much for inviting me to speak to you here today. As Walter says, this is joint work with Fernando Reichick, who's at the University of Minnesota, and I'd like to tell you about some numerical methods inspired by our analysis for electromagnetic and acoustic scattering. Okay, so what's the problem that we have in mind? Well, the setup is going to be two-dimensional for this talk, and yet I think a lot of the ideas, well, they are going to go through to the full three-dimensional problem. But as you know, if you've worked on scattering in the context of Maxwell's equations, things get a lot more complicated when you want to solve the full set of Maxwell equations. So the ideas will present in just two dimensions. So you've got some sort of plane wave, which is incident upon this grating, this diffraction grating, and it's going to be time harmonic, and it's going to have a wave number, alpha minus beta. And if the grating is complicated, then stuff's going to scatter off, and it's going to be quite complicated as well. And then g of x is the shape of my scatterer. So here's what I just said. The incident radiation is given by vi tilde, and it's this time harmonic plane wave. My diffraction grating is going to be impenetrable and d-periodic. And we want to solve for the scattered field, which I'm going to denote v sub s tilde, and in a second I'm just going to call it v. And actually life is much more easy because you've got a linear problem, and the total field is the sum of the incident field plus the scattered field if nothing penetrates the scatterer. And I just want to say that this is not just for electromagnetics, it's also for linear acoustics, and it's just a matter of how you interpret the v tilde. In electromagnetics, it corresponds to either the z component of the electric or the magnetic field, and in acoustics it corresponds to the pressure. And I should just say that when you extend acoustics, linear acoustics, to 3D, you're going to keep the same set of equations that we have here, but if you extend all of this to three-dimensional electromagnetics, then things do get a bit more complicated. So the scattered field, v sub s, which I'm now going to call v, propagates according to Helmholtz's equation because it's time harmonic. And now the parameter k is related to the wave number of the incident radiation. And now you need some boundary conditions to specify a unique solution. And one that you specify is at the diffraction grating itself. And there's any number of things you can specify. One thing you can specify is that the total field is equal to zero at the scatterer. And in that case, the scattered field is minus the incident field. Other things you can enforce are a Neumann condition. The derivative, normal derivative, is equal to zero at the surface of the scatterer, or some sort of Roban condition. And now, the periodicity of the grating, coupled with the fact that you're solving Helmholtz's equation rather than, say, Laplace's equation, is going to result in a scattered field which is not periodic, but quasi-periodic. And so it's not really a big deal, and in fact, if k is equal to zero, you do get periodic solutions. However, it does lead to some formulas which are slightly more complicated than they would be if k was equal to zero. And now Walter said that there's a connection to water waves in all of this, and the connection is along the following lines. If you want to solve the problem of water waves, you can imagine, it's even blue. G of x might be the shape of your water wave, and you want to solve not Helmholtz's equation, but Laplace's equation, k equals zero, not above the water, but below the water. So a lot of what I'm going to say immediately translates to the situation of computing water waves. What makes water waves more difficult is that it's an evolution problem, a nonlinear evolution problem. So you solve Laplace below the surface of the water, but the surface of the water propagates according to a nonlinear evolution equation. Electromagnetics is a bit tougher because the shape of the profile in general is incredibly rough, perhaps just a sawtooth, perhaps some sort of binary grating, which is not even basically continuous. Okay. And now there's a complication in scattering problems, and it's the following. What's the final boundary condition that you need to specify in order to get a unique solution? Well, you've got your problem posed on a domain of infinite extent. You need to specify the behavior of solutions as you get very far away from the diffraction grating. And so what Sommerfeld tells us is that you should satisfy the so-called Sommerfeld radiation conditions. Scattered waves should be outgoing. And now trying to enforce this condition in computational problems is a source of unending problems. And in fact, I have worked with Nilam Anigam, who's sitting in the audience, along these lines for a slightly different problem. In this problem, What we're going to do is enforce something quite simple, I think, and it comes from the following observation. So if you're strictly above the scatterer, then you can express the solution of Helmholtz's equation by a separation of variables, and this is the so-called Rayleigh series. And the constants that come out are these alpha p's and beta p's, and if k was equal to zero, then these alpha p's would just be the typical wave numbers you get for some sort of periodic solution. And I should point out that the character of the solution is going to change depending on whether the p is big enough so that k squared minus alpha sub p is positive or negative. If k squared minus alpha p squared is positive, then beta sub p is real, and so you do get an e to the I beta py, and things are propagating away from the scatterer. However, if k squared minus alpha p squared is less than zero, then you get something imaginary, and of course you're going to want to choose the root so that when you put it back in here, things are decaying rather than growing. And in fact, only a finite number of the p's satisfy the condition that you get propagating modes, and everything else just dies away exponentially. And that'll come back later in the talk. What I want to do is pose or enforce this Sommerfeld radiation condition not at infinity, but at a boundary at some finite location. And so I'm going to introduce a non-reflecting boundary condition, a transparent boundary condition, in the following way. I'm going to set up a boundary at y is equal to sigma. I'm going to define the Dirichlet and Neumann operator for the first time, it'll come back again, as the normal derivative at this surface sigma, and now sigma is going to be strictly above the scatterer, so we can use the Rayleigh series. And the Dirichlet data here is xi, it's the field at the artificial boundary, and then the Neumann data is going to be what's produced when you take the normal derivative and evaluate at the boundary. And here's my little picture. And it's the same picture, but now I put in the artificial boundary here at sigma. Now, of course, this is going to be complicated if sigma is quite general. So the key is to choose a simple sigma, and then you actually gain something. And the easiest thing to think of is let's just choose a constant function. Let's just choose A, some number, which is strictly bigger than the L infinity norm of G. And now at A, you can compute the Dirichlet and Neumann operator fairly straightforwardly. The normal derivative is just basically d by dy. We chose a minus sign for various reasons. And now if you remember the solution by separation of variables to Helmholtz's equation, take a y derivative, evaluate at y is equal to A, you get this following expansion, and this is your normal derivative. And now, any xi can be expanded, so xi is a quasi-periodic function of x, can be expanded as this sort of Fourier series. And all we're doing is we're multiplying on the Fourier side by this factor, I minus I beta sub p. And the way you should think of this is that beta sub p, put it back on the real side with this notation d, it's a pseudo-differential operator of order 1 acting on this function xi. It basically takes a derivative. Okay, and so now the Sommerfeld radiation condition can be equivalently stated at y is equal to A using the following formula. Basically, the y derivative of v is equal to the y derivative of v. But it's not a tautology because in computing t, you're taking into account the Sommerfeld radiation condition using a solution that satisfies that. So now we've got the problem posed on a finite domain. And there it is. And now I want to outline two classical boundary perturbation approaches to computing scattering. And I want to point out their flaws. And then I want to talk about ways to ameliorate these flaws. So what am I going to talk about? Two classical methods. We're going to use a boundary perturbation approach. In other words, we're going to view G as a small perturbation of a flat scatterer. Clearly, in the case of a flat scatterer, all this is trivial. And so let's base some numerical methods, some perturbative procedures on this observation. The first approach is what I'm going to call field expansions, and it's called that simply because the field V, you expand in powers of delta, and you find a set of problems that an expansion of V in powers of delta must satisfy, and then you just compute to your heart's content. The second approach is not quite as straightforward, and yet it's closely related. And in this approach, you recast the Helmholtz equation as an integral equation, and you're all set to find a solution, provided you can compute a normal derivative of the field at the scatterer. Of course, that's just going to be the Dirichlet-Neumann operator again, but now not at y is equal to a, but at y is equal to g at the boundary, at the surface of the scatterer. And now if the scatterer is non-trivial, this is going to be a non-trivial calculation. So we compute this Dirichlet-Neumann operator perturbatively. Okay, let me just go over field expansions quickly. Day one of electromagnetics class is a time harmonic plane wave coming in with wave number alpha minus beta to something flat and impenetrable is going to scatter off with wave number alpha plus beta. So this is the basis for a perturbation approach. And you make the guess that the field is actually going to be analytic as a function of this delta. And now you derive problems for the nth coefficient of this perturbation expansion, V sub n. And here's what you find. Helmholtz's equation is preserved. And now the Sommerfeld variation condition is preserved as is. Those are both linear conditions. And where something non-trivial happens is actually enforcing this Dirichlet condition at the surface of the scatterer. And so what you do is you take V at x and delta G, and you expand in powers of delta, and this is what you arrive at. This is the nth term, the expansion of the incident field. And now these are V at x and delta G at lower orders. And then that's V at the nth order. And so now you can imagine a numerical procedure where if you've solved for all the V sub L's for L from 0 up to n minus 1, now you should be able to solve at order V sub n. And now you can ask some questions about whether this method is going to work. I mean, this method goes back to Rayleigh, you know, back in the 1800s. It's the first thing you'd think of doing. And yet, in numerical experiments, I mean, Rayleigh, of course, only did things up to first or second order. And before the advent of the modern computer, all you could basically do was maybe fourth or fifth order. Enter the computer, you can all of a sudden do these expansions up to 100th, 200th order if you'd like. And yet people noticed that there was this terrible numerical performance for these algorithms. First of all, if you took n to be large, and or if you took delta to be large, if you take delta a large, you need n large in order to get a good solution. So there was this long raging controversy, and it was essentially settled by Bruno and Reisig in a paper in 1992, where they showed that if the shape of the scattering profile is analytic, then V is not only analytic in delta, it's actually jointly analytic in every variable in sight, x, y, and delta. And you can analytically continue this V in delta for any delta in a neighborhood of the real axis. And now their method of proof is interesting. They showed that the field could be expressed as some sort of integral equation. And they put all their functions in classes of holomorphic functions, and then showed that you could invert this integral operator, and then drew the conclusions that they needed. By a completely different approach, I and Fernando have shown that if G is only C2, then V, first of all, is analytic in delta. As a matter of fact, it can be analytically continued for all delta in the neighborhood of the real line. And then furthermore, if you make the assumption that G is analytic, then you can recover the Bruno-Reisig results. So it's a different method, and I'll talk about it in just a second. One thing that's important about it is that it's something that's numerically something you can numerically implement, as opposed to the Bruno and Reisig approach, which of course you can implement numerically, but it is not sort of a boundary perturbation approach. And just for later reference, this is how we implemented this FE approach when we put up slides of numerical convergence or divergence. What we did at order n is we said that our solution is going to be quasi-periodic, and it's going to look like this, basically by separation of variables again. Because you did the boundary perturbations, the Helmholtz equation is satisfied for y greater than 0. This satisfies Helmholtz. It also satisfies the Sommerfeld radiation condition. And now all you need to satisfy is this condition at y is equal to 0, and that gives you a recursion on these basically Fourier coefficients dnp in terms of previous DLQs convolved with powers of g, which appeared in the formulas for p sub n. Okay, so in some sense, there's no numerical method here. There was no discretization. All you're doing is solving for the modes dnp. Let me talk briefly about the operator expansions approach. And as I said before, it's based on recasting the Helmholtz equation in terms of the Helmholtz integral, where phi is a periodized Green's function. And then you rewrite it a little bit because you want to identify the Dirichlet and Neumann operator. So Fi is the incident radiation, but V scattered at the surface of the scatterer is minus the incident radiation. And then the normal derivative of V at the surface of the scatterer, well, that's the given Dirichlet data, that's the Neumann data. So you can express that in terms of the Dirichlet data, F sub I, in terms of the DNO. So you can massage this formula a bit and then basically solve the scattering problem once you have the Rayleigh amplitudes, the B sub P's. So in the Rayleigh expansion, you had B sub P's times e to the I alpha px plus I beta py. Once you have those B sub B's, you solve the scattering problem. So with this, you can do it, provided you can compute the Dirichlet and Neumann operator. And I should say that this approach goes back to a fellow by the name of Milder, who worked on this in the early 90s and mid-90s, and he developed approaches for computing these Dirichlet-Neumann operators perturbatively. How are you going to do this? Well, again, if the hypersurface you're working around is just flat, if g is identically equal to 0, then the Dirichlet-Neumann operator is quite simple. It's, again, going to be just this pseudo-differential operator of order 1, this minus I beta sub d. But now if g is non-zero, then again you assume that the Dirichlet-Neumann operator is going to be analytic in d. You expand, and you derive a formula for the nth term in the expansion of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. And this is a little bit more involved in the field expansions approach, but not too bad. This is what you arrive at eventually. So given Dirichlet at xc, you take all these derivatives, you multiply by powers of g, you operate with these pseudo-differential operators of order 1, and out is your nth term in your expansion. And again, you can ask about the convergence behavior of this sort of approach. And now these results are a little bit misleading because I think they're all in the case k is equal to 0, but I don't think it's too surprising that they should hold for general k as well. If you look back at the work of Calderon and Koifman and Mayer on singular integral operators, you can deduce that if g is only Lipschitz, then this Dirichlet and Neumann operator is analytic for delta sufficiently small. And this was a sort of a two-dimensional result. X is one-dimensional and y is one-dimensional. And then you can look to the results of Craig and Schantz and Sulem and Craig and myself. And we all showed that if g was C1, then the DNO is analytic for delta sufficiently small. This was in 3D and then n dimensions. And I think we decided at some point that you could probably get this for Lipschitz profiles as well, but we still had to figure out all the details. But then in a result that was analogous to the previous result from 2003 of myself and Fernando, we showed that if g was sufficiently regular, it had to be c 3 halves for various reasons, then again the Dirichlet and Neumann operator is analytic for any delta on the real line. You can analytically continue it. And again, the big difference between these first two results and this third result is the method of proof. The first two results relied on an integral equations formulation of the Dirichlet and Neumann operator, whereas our approach was something that was numerically could be implemented. And then we showed joint analyticity. And the reason we got interested in this at all in the first place is the following observation that was bothering us. If you believe Calderon and Koifman and Mayer, they say that G only has to be Lipschitz, and this expansion should make sense. And yet, look what you're doing to this poor innocent function G. You're taking C, hitting it with a derivative, multiplying, another derivative, and now if n is big, many, many pseudo-differential operators of order 1. And so in theory, you know, 1,000 derivatives are hitting this product of g with xi. And so how on earth can that make sense? How can you get convergence of this series when you're doing such bad things to a Lipschitz profile? And the conclusion that we came to is that there are significant cancellations in these formulas where big derivative hitting G somewhere here cancels out exactly with big derivative hitting G somewhere in this sum here, which is fine analytically, but a terrible idea numerically. And then let me just say, there's going to be some graphs where we talk about PFE rather than FE. What's the difference? Well, if you just take the field expansions approach that I talked about before and then compare it to operator expansions always wins. And so you think and think, why is this true? If you think about what happens in the operator expansions approach, the incident field is not expanded in powers of delta, whereas the DNO is expanded. If you do field expansions in the most honest way, you expand not only the incident field, but also, remember that piece of n, in powers of delta. So to put ourselves on the equal footing with operator expansions, we did not expand the incident radiation in powers of delta, but we did expand into the piece of n's. So slight modification which puts operator expansions and field expansions on the same level. So PFE is better than FE, but it has to be because you're giving more information at the scatterer. Okay, so let me just say that I'm about to point out some of the deficiencies of these boundary perturbation approaches, and yet, in many, many scenarios, they're absolutely the best possible thing. They're fast, they're efficient, and they're highly accurate within their domain of applicability. They are dimension-reducing in that if you count the number of parameters that you need in order to compute an approximation to the scattered field, in some sense you only need to discretize in the x direction. You only had to sum over p's, e to the I alpha p x. Somehow you're able to solve exactly in the y direction. So this is clearly an advantage over full volumetric approaches where you would discretize between the scatterer and y is equal to a using some sort of, say, finite element approach or some sort of spectral collocation approach. The big competition for these methods is integral equations methods, and you know, it's good competition, especially in two dimensions. Certain fortuitous facts work to the advantage of the integral equations methods. First of all, that trapezoidal rule in 2D is spectrally accurate. And a lot of work has been put into finding good high-order quadrature rules for these integral equations methods. In three dimensions, things are not quite so good. The singularities you get are bad. You don't have such easily attainable quadrature rules. And in the end, there's a big matrix that you have to invert. You have to work very hard to get a good preconditioner, and still it may take a long time for things to converge. Operator expansions, field expansions, this partial field expansions approach, they all extend rather trivially to three dimensions. All you have to do is view, rather than alpha p being some real number, it's some sort of two-vector. You just have to get the indexing right. In addition, you can do quite large scatterers because of the fact that these fields can be analytically continued in delta, and the question becomes, how do you get to deltas which are outside the disk of convergence of the Taylor series? Well, one classical approach to doing this is through Padé approximation. And so sometimes it works great, sometimes, well, not so well. Many times it does work very, very well, and it's allowed the approximation of scattering configurations with very large or very irregular boundaries. And I just love this slide. Utility of shape perturbation methods. The best thing is that this is not our paper. Okay, you can't make this stuff up. So this is Denizen and Jan Hesthaven in a series of two papers in the Journal of the Optical Society of America back in 2000 and 2001. And what they were studying were grating couplers. So they had three or four layers of material that they were going to pass these plane waves through, and they were going to scatter all over the place, and some stuff was going to come out, and some was going to propagate through. And they took two approaches to trying to resolve this numerically. They took a spectral collocation approach, which is absolutely right up the alley of Jan Hesthaven and company, where they did sort of a volumetric discretization of the whole device, and then did spectral collocation. And then they compared this to, well, boundary variations was the first name of field expansions before we realized that operator expansions was there as well. That's the Bruno Reitig algorithm that they first wrote down back in the mid-90s. And this is their table, copied verbatim, of three calculations. Amplitude is the amplitude of one of the boundaries between two of these substrates. Absolutely. Size of G. And they ran these comparisons, and this is just running time. So 46 seconds versus 30 seconds, 30 hours. 30 or 90 seconds versus 64 hours. They set some sort of criterion for when they had a well-resolved solution, and this is what came out. And the difference between this chart and this chart is that this was two-dimensional. This was three-dimensional. This was actually electromagnetic scattering. So this is more complicated than just Helmholtz. It's the full set of Maxwell equations. And here they compare spectral collocation to boundary variations in terms of memory and CPU time. So if I would have made this data up, you can't make up data like this. Yes? I'll get Jan to send you the code. Oh. Okay, but now let me point out some flaws in these boundary perturbation approaches. Okay. Let me pick on operator expansions. The same sort of thing can be said for field expansions. It's a little bit more involved to show that this actually is the case, but the mechanism is the same. So let's just look at the first couple of terms in the expansion of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. So recall that the zeroth order term is just this pseudo-differential operator of order 1. And now believe me that the first term, or the next term in the expansion, looks something along these lines. And again, it seems to involve two derivatives hitting C and G. And yet, the Dirichlet-Neumann operator should only be taking roughly one derivative. So something must cancel in this formula right here. So what turns out to be true is there's a product rule of sorts for this pseudo-differential operator of order 1. The derivative can be passed over onto beta, or onto eta at the cost of a remainder, and of course the remainder is just a commutator. And the idea is that the commutator is smoother than either of the first two things. And so this is part of the complication of doing things with scattering, is that the operator beta sub delta squared is not just d squared, but k squared minus d squared. It all comes from the relationship alpha p squared plus beta p squared equals k squared. And so what you can do is you can use the real product rule on this first term. So you get a dg, and then the d hits c. You got a k squared. And now you use this quote-unquote product rule for beta sub d. And what you notice is that this guy and this guy and this guy all cancel out all of the terms where it appears that second derivatives are hitting G and C. If you're sufficiently patient, you can do the same thing for T sub 2. And let's see, there's six terms, or maybe there's eight terms, six of which drop out. And I've used the product rule twice, I believe. Here's two remainders. And then this guy, S sub G, is made up of these two remainders. And you can actually see that S sub F is even smoother than the R's. It, again, is going to be a commutator. And we've explicitly canceled out all the terms where the higher derivatives hit. And so now the first thing that we wanted to convince ourselves of is that if you implemented numerically this guy, as opposed to this guy, you would get more stable calculations. So we coded them both up, and we looked at rather rough profiles. Their Dirichlet data and the shape of the profile have Fourier transforms decaying like 1 over p squared, so that's continuous, but not C1, I think. And then we computed this T sub 2, and then in the field expansions approach, you see these same sorts of calculations, but it occurs at one order higher for various reasons. We took NX to be, well, somewhat large, 2048. And then we computed T sub 2 and V sub 3 without taking into account the cancellations, and we compared those to a very highly resolved calculation, one that was actually done in quadruple precision. And what you see is, well, first of all, things in this case are a little bit better for V sub 3, but with T sub 2, for most wave numbers above 100, you're making a relative error of at least 10 to the minus 10. And it gets worse as the wave number increases. That was for K quite small. I believe it was 1 or square root of 2. This is for K in the range of about 10 or so. Of course, K is an important scaling parameter. When you make K very, very large, that's high-frequency scattering, and these methods really are not going to be terribly appropriate for that. That's a whole different kettle of fish. So I'm talking about what's called the resonance regime, where K is of order 1, order 10. Oh, here we go. Alpha, beta is 100, 100. And it actually gets worse than it was before for both algorithms. These cancellations exist at all orders. And then what do I want to say? Three profiles, a smooth one, a rough one, and a Lipschitz one. And then we computed the difference between the OE approximations and the FE approximations to a highly resolved calculation. And I'm going to show you a bunch of pictures. So this is just the evaluation of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator, which comes from that OE approach. And here are the various parameters. Delta is 0.09, NX is only 64, and we're comparing it to a numerical implementation of the method of proof I'm going to tell you about in just a second. And so for the smooth profile, you see that for a while, for N up to about 15 or 16, these boundary perturbation approaches do very, very well, and they compare exactly with our new stabilized approach. But there's always a point, those in N, of diminishing returns at which your calculations start getting worse. And as N is increased further and further, your calculations start to diverge wildly. It gets worse as delta gets larger. It gets worse as the smoothness of the profile goes down. So the first calculation was for a cosine profile. This one's for a C4 profile. The divergence in the previous graph took place around 15 or 16. Now it's taking place at 9 or 10. And now you go to a Lipschitz profile, and it's taking place at 6 or 7. And in the case of water waves, maybe this isn't such a terrible thing because the shape of a water wave is typically analytic. But if you're trying to do scattering, you really are trying to do scattering off of a Lipschitz profile. Okay, so let's come back to the question of convergence now that we've seen that these OE and FE methods are somewhat vulnerable when N gets very large. So you can try and investigate this and say to yourself, well, what's the first thing I would try in trying to establish the analyticity of the field V? Well, you'd look at your FE recursions. You probably wouldn't write down an integral equation. And you'd say they satisfy Helmholtz's equation with some boundary conditions. Let's use classical elliptic theory and try and get estimates on the V sub n's. So V sub n in some space can be estimated in terms of the boundary data. You put in this boundary data. And the only thing you really know what to do with the P sub n's is use the triangle inequality. And the claim is that by doing this, you destroy the cancellations that are present in these recursions that allow the things to converge. A couple of ways of trying to convince you of this is if you consider an analytic profile, if you've got cancellations for a Lipschitz profile, you've got cancellations for an analytic profile, say g is equal to 2 of cosine x, and now you look at the DNPs, which come from the field expansions approach, it turns out that at order 1, you get Fourier coefficients for minus 1 and plus 1. At order 2, you get Fourier coefficients at minus 2, 0, and 2, and sort of a leading edge of Fourier coefficients at order n, at wave number n. And it's a small miracle, but you can find a recursion for the DNNs in terms of the DLLs alone along this sort of leading edge. So call capital D sub n DNN, write down this recursion, and now let's try and take this formula and destroy the cancellations. Let's consider the majorizing sequence where every time you see, well, basically take the triangle inequality and apply it to the right-hand side. And clearly delta n bounds the d sub n's an absolute value. And if this approach using the triangle inequality has any hope of working, then the delta n's have to converge if they're going to be useful. Here's our plots. I don't know how good they came out. Ah, not so brilliant. And I want to show two things. On the left, you've got two lines where I've computed d sub n, and then we took log base 10, computed things in exact arithmetic using an algebraic manipulator, Maple, and then computed things in double precision. For a while, the two curves lay right on top of each other, but after a while, the d sub n's in finite precision diverge, and it's because of these cancellations. And basically what's going on, these high derivatives, if you think about them in terms of some sort of spectral method for solving this problem, high derivatives amount to wave number k, which in general is going to be nx over 2 for the largest wave number, to a big power, minus some other k to a large power, and they've got to subtract and come out to 0, or something very, very small. And this is day one of numerical analysis. A terrible idea is to try and compute something small as the difference of two big numbers. That's precisely what's going on. And as further evidence of these cancellations, here is d sub n. This is a root test on d sub n, computed in exact arithmetic. It does have a radius of convergence, whereas the delta sub n's do not. And actually, Fernando and Abner Friedman showed in a related context that, in fact, the delta n's have a zero radius of convergence. So all of this led us to the following line of reasoning. Let's attempt to follow the field expansions approach, but before we get started, let's make a change of variables. And the change of variables is going to leave the x-coordinates alone, and it's going to flatten out the domain. It's going to map g to 0, and it's going to map the artificial boundary at a to a again, or 1. No, it maps it to a. Of course, the field transforms, and your problem transforms. Now, the cost of all this is that you lose the homogeneous right-hand side on the Helmholtz equation, and that'll have numerical consequences. Now, with this new problem, you make your perturbation expansion. Field expansions transformed, again, partial. We're not going to expand the incident radiation at the scatterer. You get these equations as functions of n. And now look at the f sub n, the right-hand sides of Helmholtz's equation. Well, you get previous iterates, previous u sub l's. You get gradients of them. You get g's, and then you get more derivatives. But you never get more than one or two derivatives on the right-hand side, as opposed to the p sub n's, where you had derivatives, pseudo-differential operators of arbitrary order on the right-hand side, which suggests that perhaps this approach is going to be not so badly conditioned, not relying so heavily on big cancellations. And in fact, now you can carry out the procedure that I outlined before. Take this equation for the u sub n's, use elliptic theory to estimate u sub n in terms of the right-hand side, and now proceed by induction. Start at order 0, show that you can get the bound that you'd like. Assume that you get the bound for all u sub l's at lower orders. Look at u sub capital N. And now the fn, qn, and rn all involve just the g's and then the u's at previous orders. You use the triangle inequality, and it works because it doesn't destroy any cancellations. There are no cancellations there, really, to be destroyed. And as long as you choose your constant sufficiently big, and the size of b is governed by the size of your scatterer, the disk of convergence gets smaller as g gets rougher and rougher, then this straightforward approach works. And in fact, if you are ambitious enough, you can show that not only are things analytic in delta, it's analytic in y, it's analytic in x, and you can analytically continue in the deltas. And it's all a variation on this Simple theme. You just make the right change of coordinates. And so having this in hand led us to consider improved algorithms for doing these scattering calculations. Okay, so in the engineering literature, it is still very important to be able to have to do stably low-order calculations. A first-order or second-order approximation to a scattering configuration is absolutely something that engineers use. And so, rather than just focusing on a high-order method, we wanted to see if we can improve low-order methods as well. So our improved low-order scheme is basically a numerical implementation of these canceled formulas that I showed you before. So what you do is you sit down with T0, T1, and T2. Well, T0 doesn't have any cancellations that need to be made. But with T1 and T2, you make the cancellations that you need to do. You put in the remainders. And now you code up the remainders very carefully. If you just code them up as the difference as they're defined, well, then you're just putting back in all the subtraction of big numbers that you work so hard to take out. So for instance, in the case of R sub f, here's the pth Fourier coefficient of R sub f. What you do is you write out, let's see, what was R equal? It was f eta with the derivative acting on it, and then it was f times the derivative acting on eta. And that minus sign is the reason for our concern. So you rewrite this, multiply the top and the bottom simply by beta p plus beta p minus q, and then you write out the numerator. And what you find is that things cancel out. And after all the dust has settled, you've got coefficients that are going to multiply f hat q and eta hat p minus q, which are sums on the top and the bottom. Now, for better or worse, you cannot do this fast. You cannot use the fast Fourier algorithm to accelerate this. So you have to do sort of a slow convolution. But it can be done. You can do the same sort of thing for PFE. You can do the same sort of thing for S, again, if you're patient enough. And now, oh, the middle stuff is just not showing up at all. And so now what I'm going to show you is the results of three approaches to computing the scattering configuration as compared to a highly resolved calculation. Up on top is this OE result that I showed you many, many slides ago. So this is, don't do any of the cancellations explicitly. Do all of your convolutions using the fast Fourier transform algorithm. And these are the errors that you get at each of the wave numbers for that particular profile. Compared with that is what we call the slow OE approach, and you can't see it at all, unfortunately, because I think it was yellow, and then that translated into white, apparently, in black and white. This is the exact same approach as this, except you don't use the fast Fourier transform algorithm to compute your convolutions. Turns out that the FFT is somewhat ill-conditioned in computing these convolution products. And so for a very rough profile like this, you have to work hard to see the difference. You get a little bit better performance. Finally, compared to what we call the improved OE formulation, you go through, you take all the time to make the cancellation explicitly, and now you compute, and you see that uniformly, through the set of wave numbers, you get errors which are 10 to the minus 14. And so you can make gains at the highest wave number of, you know, 8 orders of magnitude. And that's basically our improved low-order approach. This is for alpha beta a little bit higher, and you see the same sorts of results. It actually gets a little bit better with our new approach. This is for the partial field expansions. You see the same sort of behavior. Things are much more subtle for the field expansions cancellations. It's more difficult to recognize them. It's more difficult to see a difference numerically. And here, to tell you the truth, the slow PFE and the improved PFE are sort of in a cloud together, although we like to squint and see that the improved method is a little bit lower. You see the same sorts of results, a little bit lower. Oops. We have two ideas on higher order methods. I'll certainly get to the first, and maybe I'll get to the second as well. The first is basically implement numerically our proof. The second is decide what was important about this change of variables and then try and implement that numerically. So this was the change of variables, flattened out the domain, gave us a new field. The new field satisfied new equations. Make an expansion. The U sub n's satisfy these equations where the right-hand side looks like this. And now here's the problem with PDFE, is that you lose the dimension-reducing benefit that you had with operator expansions and field expansions. You've got a right-hand side, and it depends on x and y. You can't write down in a simple closed form what the eigenfunctions are for that differential operator. You have to discretize in x. You have to discretize in y as well. So we're working on ways to make that a bit better. Yeah, although it, right. So there's a lot of ways you can go in this sort of y direction. So we do a spectral Chebyshev method in the y direction, and that chooses a certain set of points near the boundary. Absolutely. So it chooses a certain set of points. But now you have to think about what's the solution going to look like. For k small or k zero. Everything decays exponentially fast away from the scatterer. So why put all these points near the artificial boundary, stack them up near the scatterer, and maybe the A can be quite close. If K is big, a lot of stuff is propagating away, and there's a lot of fine detail that you need to capture, and we actually saw that in our numerical runs. We didn't change A as we went to a high scattering high frequency configuration, and we got junk, and so we had to make A much, much smaller. But no, you're right, there's a lot of possible directions to go to try and improve this method. What am I going to show you? An operator expansion's approximation to the Dirichlet-Neumann operator, which shows its dimension-reducing character. Your coefficients only need to depend on the perturbation parameter and sort of the x wave numbers. The same sort of thing for the partial field expansions approach. You solve for these coefficients d and p. And then my transformed partial field expansions approach, where you have to discretize both in the x variable and in the y variable. And as I said before, we're going to use Chebyshev polynomials for our basis functions, but you don't have to. Two profiles, a smooth one, and then one that doesn't have a very complicated formula, and that you put together some sines and cosines, and all of a sudden you get a profile which looks rather rough. So we were trying to get a little profile that looks kind of like the ocean. We're going to do ocean scattering. And now, how do you measure the error? Well, there's two ways of going. One way of going is the so-called measure in energy defect. It turns out that if your grading is, lossless, then if you look at the amplitudes of all the propagating modes, and you look at their absolute value, you sum up for all the propagating modes the size of the Rayleigh amplitude and the scaling factor, then you should get 1. So how much you miss this by is your energy defect. Now, there's problems with the energy defect. Of course, you could have a lower energy defect and be doing a terrible job of resolving your scattering calculation, partly because the energy defect really focuses on the low wave numbers. It's only those wave numbers for which you get things propagating that matter. But of course, plane wave scattering off of a complicated geometry, you don't have an exact solution for, so you don't have that option available. In order to sort of mimic that situation, what we did is we changed the problem a little bit from plane wave scattering to, I'm going to dream up my favorite solution of Helmholtz's equation, and then I'm going to evaluate it at the surface, and that's some Dirichlet data. That comes from some incident radiation, which is not a plane wave. Exactly. I'm manufacturing the exact solution. You can get Dirichlet data from that, and now you've got the DNO. So this is the second set of norms that we use, computing currents, the derivative of the field at the boundary. Oh, finally, I need to tell you about Pade. When I say we're going to use Pade approximation, what do I mean? Let's consider, for instance, in the case of computing the Dirichlet-Neumann operator, perturbatively, what do any of these methods eventually give you? They give you a sum over orders, a sum over wave numbers, coefficients times complex exponentials and powers of delta. We rearrange these sums, which may or may not be totally justified, and we put the sum over the orders on the inside, and that's a Taylor polynomial, and you can evaluate that inside the disk of convergence, and it converges. However, outside of the radius of convergence of this Taylor series, what you can do is approximate this polynomial by a rational function, a quotient of two polynomials, whose orders sum up to the order of the polynomial plus some error. And that these rational functions, these Pade approximants, have remarkable properties. They converge better for delta within the disk of convergence. They converge for sometimes delta outside the disk of convergence. And now there's a bunch of pictures I can show you. Maybe I'll just show you a couple. This is a measure of energy defect for the smooth profile. Here are my parameters. And this is just doing Taylor summation as n increases. And what I want to show here is the eventual divergence of the OE and PFE methods, while the PTFE method does keep on converging. You throw Pade approximation into the mix, and now, as opposed to errors which were 10 to the minus 3 or 4, all of a sudden you're getting errors for PTFE, which are 10 to the minus 14 or so. What this also points out is that despite the fact in the previous graph it all sort of looked like a mess and they were all pretty much doing the same sort of thing, that in those last couple of terms there was useful information to be extracted, and the Pade approximation scheme allows you to do this, enough information so that you get five orders of magnitude improvement from one scheme to the next. Computing at order 30 does make a difference. And now let me just give you the same configuration, again a smooth profile, but now I've taken my height to period, my height of my scatterer, to be big enough so that you're outside the disk of convergence of the Taylor series. And you can see that this is the case. First of all, PFE and OE are diverging, but this stable scheme, PTFE, is also diverging. It's not PTFE's fault, it's just outside the disk of convergence. And yet with Pade, it not only helps PTFE get down to errors of 10 to the minus 8, it actually helps out FE and OE as well. Roughly how much time do I have? Okay, I'll tell you the whole story then, but I won't take too long. Wrap it up. Okay, so the same sorts of results, but now with this rough profile. And the Reader's Digest of this is that the same sorts of observations you can make, again in this case, they're a bit more pronounced now. That was inside the disk of convergence with, first of all, Taylor, and now with Pade. And now outside the disk with Taylor and with Pade. And boy, moderate height, rough profile. Again, energy defect, Taylor and Pade, large height, Taylor and Pade, and I believe this is higher frequency. This is a calculation of the E sub P's are called efficiencies, and so you have a finite set of efficiencies, and we just wanted to compute efficiency by efficiency, how well we were converging using these three techniques. This is with Pade. So this is in a scattering configuration where E sub minus 15 is sort of the last efficiency that gets into the set of propagating modes. And here's one of the first one that gets in, E sub 4. And so you really see the advantages of TFE with these efficiencies that are way out at the edges. And now these are comparisons of currents. And I guess the point of these plots is that if you looked carefully at the first set of plots, it seemed like OE and PFE were doing pretty well up to about N equals 40 or 50. But again, the measure of energy defect is a little bit biased. It's completely biased towards the lower wave numbers, the lower P's. Whereas this exact solution takes into account all the wave numbers, and you see that in fact, that was being a bit generous to OE and PFE, things in that exact same configuration are diverging at actually 16 or 10 rather than at 40 or 50. Moderate frequency. Ah, finally, the final punchline. What was it about the PTFE method that made it so great? Well, one thing we can observe about these different methods is that part of the problem with the classical boundary perturbation approaches is that it seems that you do this boundary perturbation, and the whole advantage is that now you get problems that are on y greater than or equal to 0, but then possibly some complicated conditions at the boundary. If you think about it, you're taking derivatives of the field across the boundary, the domain of definition of this problem. So the domain has got a boundary which goes up and down and up and down. There are going to be points which are greater than y, or greater than 0, which in the original configuration sometimes are inside the domain of your computation, sometimes outside. Whereas if you do a domain transformation at the start, and then you start taking derivatives, now you're sure that all your derivatives that you're taking are legal. So let's try and do the following thing. Let's try and maintain the dimension-reducing properties of OE and FE, and yet always do interior differentiations. Here's one implementation. Compute not the Dirichlet to Neumann operator, but the Dirichlet to interior derivative operator, the DIDO. We're at a loss for acronyms. We're really running out. And here's my slide. Here's the scatterer, which again came out in a rather light, here it is, it's even lighter, again yellow. Here's y equals g. We're going to consider a family of curves which at parameter delta equals 0 is way inside the domain, and now as you increase delta all the way to 1, eventually becomes the surface of the scatterer. We're going to take Dirichlet data at the scatterer and now compute derivatives at these surfaces, which is going to be incredibly smoothing. And then you're going to let delta go to 1. Now, clearly, delta equals 1 is going to be a bad point. So you can imagine you can try letting delta get bigger and bigger and then see if your numerics are improved. So this is what we do. Consider these interior surfaces. At delta equals 1, you do get G. And at delta equals 0, you get B. And now compute this operator, which is the gradient of the field evaluated at this interior surface dotted with this normal, which is actually at the surface. So it's sort of a funny operator. Do the operator expansions dance? Expand in powers of delta. You compute this T sub n. I'm going to call it T sub n tilde because it's not quite the Dirichlet to Neumann operator. And you notice all these smoothing terms. Ones of the smoothing terms, I believe these guys are. Compute this, and what do you find? So this is a calculation of current at the surface for a set of parameters. And what did we do? We computed using the standard operator expansions approach, and the error goes down for a while, and then it blows up. And now we computed using this DIDO approach for different values of B. 0.05, you still sort of get down to the same smallest error, but it comes at a later N. And as you bump up B, you sort of do better and better. And of course, there's a law of diminishing returns. If you make B too big, then it's too big a jump to go from way up here all the way down to the surface of the scatterer. This is all done with Taylor summation, with Paré summation. You can do very, very well with B equals 0.15, despite the fact that it doesn't really look like your error at any N ever got much better than any of the other values of B. Maybe it got a little bit better for the larger Bs. But this, once again, points out that there is important information to be had for large N. And so when you use something like Pade, you can really see this. And then we did the same thing for this rough profile. And here you really see that despite the fact that B is growing, the absolute error, you know, doesn't really improve from one B to the next. It's just the absolute error happens, lowest error happens later and later. And then that advantage is sort of seen when you start summing things with Pade. So it's a little bit cluttered here, probably because this guy's going so badly, but this is B equals zero, and then the B's gradually increasing. So what conclusions do I want to draw? First of all, these classical shape perturbation methods, while being fast, accurate, and pretty remarkable within their domain of applicability, are not always applicable, and they do have some shortcomings. And this is mainly due to the fact that they have quite severe cancellations. Taking n big, taking delta big, can reveal these cancellations. They deliver unstable numerics and prevent a direct proof of analyticity. But you can get a proof of analyticity if you just make this change of variables first and then carry out the field expansions program. By identifying these cancellations, it gave us the ideas for designing new methods for computing these scattering configurations. At low order, what you can do is you can look at the formulas for T1 and T2, use this product rule with the smoothing terms, and explicitly make by hand these cancellations. Clearly, it becomes a bit tedious beyond second order. So we devised two high-order approaches which implicitly manage these cancellations. First of all, just implement our proof. Second of all, go with this idea of doing interior differentiations and see if you can build a numerical algorithm out of that. And this was one idea that we had along those lines, and it seemed to work pretty well. It's a bit more art than science, though, at this point. How do you choose B? What happens if delta equals 1? Well, we don't know exactly. I think that's all I have to say.